Ladies and gentlemen, welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. After the presentation, we'll conduct a question and answer session. To ask a question, please press star and then one. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this point. Now, I'll turn the meeting over to your host, Joanne Ferraglio. You may begin.
Thank you, Jacob. Welcome and thank you for joining our call today. I'm Joanne Ferraglio, Senior Investment Director at Putnam Investments, and today I'm joined by Bill Coley, the Chief Investment Officer of Putnam Fixed Income, Joanne Driscoll, the Lead Portfolio Manager on Putnam Ultrashort Duration Income Fund, and Mike Lima, Putnam's Financials Analyst and also a Portfolio Manager on Putnam Ultrashort Duration Income. So today we're going to discuss the recent Fed action and provide an update on how these actions might influence USDI. But before we begin, I just want to share a couple of housekeeping notes with you. First, you may have noticed that we did not have the opportunity to collect callers' identification as you dialed in, but we would love to hear from you and hope we get questions at the end. We'll be addressing as many questions as possible following the speaker's comments. But if you have anything above and beyond that, please reach out to your Putnam consulting team or dial 800-354-4000 in order to get your questions addressed. Secondly, with this intense period of market volatility, we are committed to sharing appropriate and timely resources that we hope can help you serve your clients. So in addition to the call we're conducting today, we are hosting a webcast series this week to provide you with strategies for your practice, wealth management, and investment management. So the following events will take place at 1:15 in the afternoons Eastern Time on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. We have Giving Clients Perspective with Don Connolly, a senior mentor to financial advisors. Wednesday, we have insights on current volatility with our Putnam Senior Investment Management team. And Thursday, we have planning opportunities for challenging markets with our Putnam Wealth Management experts, Bill Cass and Chris Hennessy. So with that, let's get started. I'm going to begin with Bill Coley. Now, Bill, you've been involved in the financial markets for over 30 years now and have experienced a wide variety of market volatility events of all different magnitudes. I'm really interested to hear your perspective on how the current events now compare or contrast with past events and your high-level thoughts on the recent Fed action that we saw implemented yesterday.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Joanne, and thank you, everybody, for dialing in this afternoon. We're looking, you know, today at obviously very, very severe dislocations in almost all markets. Looking back at, you know, sort of historical events. The tables for this have really been set after the 2008 global financial crisis, you know, where there were several regulatory changes that were put into place that essentially has, you know, made market making in the fixed income markets more challenging, really, since that environment, because dealer balance sheets, some of the traditional buffers that might have been there have been severely curtailed for, you know, really since the 08 events. So when we're out talking about products and talking about our management style, we talk about, you know, four types of risk: term premium, interest rate risk, credit risk, fundamental loss risk through credit, in whether it's in corporate bonds or in certain types of mortgages, et cetera. Refinancing risk or prepayment risk, callability, but the fourth one is liquidity risk. And liquidity risk is what we're going to be talking about today primarily, going through is managing liquidity in this environment. I think when we look at the world today, there's really sort of three pillars that are going on in terms of the stresses that the society is dealing with. The first is obviously the public health situation and the response to that. I know as we just go into this call, there's been another press conference coming from the White House and team overall, which clearly didn't provide a lot of comfort level on that side. And I think that's the most important hurdle as a, you know, as a society for us to get through. The second is fiscal policy, and fiscal policy in particular looking at earnings capability for the corporate and the corporate market here overall and getting the economy started again. And then the third is monetary policy. And a lot of the, you know, the debates that I've seen that have been taking place out there have been really on the on this this playoff between the fiscal policy response and the ability for the different agencies to act in a coordinated fashion. Overall, clearly, as the as this issue, the crisis here becomes more and more immediate, I think the probability of that coming on, you know, much more substantially is pretty high. And the but the other side has been, you know, monetary policy and what really can the scope of monetary policy provide for this for the markets. And I think one of the messages that we want to talk a little bit today is with the USDI, the Ultra Short Duration Income Fund. You know, monetary what's coming out of the Fed here is still an important feature for a lot of the assets that are being being held in this fund. So. You know, I think that the I was very relieved to see the activity that took place over the weekend on Sunday night. I think I've there's been some debate out there about whether this was more destabilizing or not because of the that it looked like it was a panic move. It came before the meeting this week, but I think one thing we learned in the 08 crisis was that, you know, the weekends can be tricky periods, and as you roll into the Asian markets and the openings there, after a couple nights of a couple days of no market information, there can be a lot of instability. So I tend to I think they made the right move by moving over the weekend, and wouldn't view it as a kind of a fear factor move. I think it was an informed decision on that side. I guess that the overall message is that while the scale of the action was pretty impressive, you know, if you look at the move to essentially a zero band on rates on the downside, which may or may not have been anticipated, but a fairly large slug, at least $500 billion of Treasury purchases, at least $200 billion of mortgages. That was all, an impressive move over in general. But I think that one thing that is clear is that the scope is incomplete. And there's been, there was no immediate move for any direct support yet for commercial paper or short-term corporate debt. And I think one of the messages you'll hear there is we think there's a need for that, a direct need for that, and anticipate something relatively quickly. I know that there was a direct question to Chairman Powell, and he cited the ability to move that direction as well. So that's the big overriding backdrop overall. I think the most important conversation here, though, is really to talk about what we're doing in terms of managing the portfolio through this environment and the programs we put in place and the skills that we have in sort of navigating this. So I'm going to turn it over back to Joanne Ferullo, who's going to introduce Joanne Driscoll, who is the lead portfolio manager on this strategy for us.
Great. Thank you, Bill. Thanks for those comments. You know, there are a couple words that you used in your comments that I think are really, applicable and bridge into USDI. When we talk about liquidity, you automatically think about the short end of the curve and monetary policy. I mean, that is one specific area of the government that actually will dramatically impact the short end of the curve and funds like USDI. So I think, with that, Joanne Driscoll, with all the market volatility and the significant policy moves that we've seen, how do you think about the strategy and positioning of the Ultra Short Duration Income Fund now versus perhaps how you might have thought about it a month or 6 months ago?
Sure. Thanks, Joanne. So for the life of the fund, we've managed with a real focus on capital preservation and liquidity. We maintain the high amount of liquidity through laddering of our maturities. So on average, we have about 3% maturing every day, and then roughly 25 to 30% in 60 days. So that natural liquidity is also supplemented with the fund owning some high quality on the run issues. And you know what we did, we went back to the fourth quarter of 19, we positioned the year end with a high amount of liquidity and up in quality bias, just in the event that the market experienced the disruptions that it experienced in the fourth quarter of 18. However, with the Fed adding liquidity to the funding market, the year end did go smooth. But as 2020 unfolded, spreads were extremely compressed and valuations were stretched. We were actually really hesitant to add risk back at that time. And if you look back at the option-adjusted spread in the 1 to 3 year corporate index, on February 12th, so just 1 month ago, it hit a tight of 40 basis points. I mean, that's a tight in the entire time the index has been around. Since that period, the spread on the 1 to 3 year index has widened out to 140 basis points. I'm sorry, 140 basis points wider at 180. So we went from 40 to 180 on 1 to 3 year securities in just the course of a month. Now, we've seen moves like that, but never in such a direct, quick move on a one-month basis. Even in the financial crisis, you saw the move higher, coming off higher levels, but over a longer period of time. But as it's been consistent with our messaging, when spreads widen, the fund will be affected due to the credit exposure. So, yes, we did see some decline in our NAV, but we're still only down 0.1% year-to-date. So we behaved pretty well with our more conservative positioning with such extreme spread widening.
Joanne, do you think that there is going to be an impact over maybe the intermediate term with the actions that the Fed are taking? It seems like it's going to take a little while for this action to start to actually influence the markets there. And what do you think that impact might be?
Right. So what the Fed did last night will definitely help stabilize the market, but it will take time to work through. You know, it's not going to happen instantaneously, but like Bill and you had both mentioned, the Fed's moves are very critical for the functioning of the liquidity system. Market liquidity is stretched, especially in the commercial paper market, as the dealer balance sheets are constrained, corporations are still needing to issue commercial paper, and we're seeing a lot of money funds hoard cash because they're concerned that they may see outflows. And what's really missing is what Bill had mentioned. It was expected by a lot of market participants that last night that they would have a targeted program that would directly support the commercial paper and the broader credit markets. And the funding market is really the plumbing of the financial system, and that needs to be unclogged to improve things in the fixed income market. So we're expecting further Fed action. They're on top of this, and it's something that they know needs to be done. A New York Fed official actually reached out to me. We had a conversation earlier today to discuss what we are seeing, and they are really well aware, and they're committed to finding some stability and liquidity within the front end of the market.
Now, one of the other things that we've seen, besides the major headlines around $700 billion in asset purchases, the Fed actually made several changes as it relates to the banking institutions and what they can do with their balance sheets. So, Mike Lima, as our financials analyst, I wondered if you could take a couple minutes and comment on, you know, your views on how this could impact the banking institutions that we invest in, their balance sheets. You know, are they prepared for this? We've always had a high degree of conviction in the U.S. banking institutions in particular. So I'm curious to get your views on how these changes could influence the banking institutions that we're investing in.
Sure, Joanne. I think it's important to point out that the Fed, it's largely responding, or over the weekend it responded to, economic risks, market conditions, and not, responding to concerns about credit profiles of the banks. In many ways, the banks are looked at as, part of the solution to the problems in the market today. So, I've covered banks for 20 years at Putnam, and I, really over the last decade post-financial crisis, and Bill kind of referenced this as well, we've just observed regulators and bank management, essentially building up bank balance sheets to face an environment like this, completely a response to what happened in 08. So the good news is the bank's starting a really, you know, strong position as this kind of crisis, you know, has started. As Bill also referenced, the bad news is that, banks, don't provide the same balance sheet that they did post, pre-2008. And, we see that reflected in, pockets of illiquidity throughout the market here. So, when you look at the Fed statement last night, they go out of their way to point to the strength of the banking system, citing $1.3 trillion of, common equity in the system, $3 trillion of, liquidity holdings in the system. And, they go on to encourage the banks to use excess capital and liquidity. So they're essentially saying they're very comfortable with the system, and they're giving new regulatory leeway to use their balance sheets further. So, there's a lot of moving pieces with, what's going on in the market and policy response. When I think about the banks, we go back to the balance sheet and, threats to capital, threats to liquidity are, what we look out for. And, you can kind of tick off a bunch of things that have kind of gone on. We're back to zero interest rates. That's not good for bank earnings. The banks were, dealing with this as recently as 2015, so it's something that they've managed through before. Asset quality starts from a really strong position. If the economy does deteriorate, we're likely to see higher credit costs, but we believe that, the earnings capacity is still enough to absorb this. I get a lot of questions about bank energy exposure.
Yes, definitely.
We've been through a mini period in 2015-16 where oil was in the mid-20s, and we kind of have a template on how banks have managed through that. We have a good handle on the exposure, and again, higher credit costs. We don't think that's something that, by itself, impairs balance sheets. And again, the Fed did a number of things to kind of grease the skids in the market as it pertains to, banks. The Fed promoting and improving the terms of the discount window. That's an interesting one. There's typically a stigma attached to accessing the discount window. We thought maybe all the big banks would go in together. Haven't seen anything like that yet. Zeroing out reserve requirements. A lot of these things are somewhat symbolic. The Fed saying that we are okay with the banks and we're promoting them to kind of step into the void here. So I think my main point here is that fundamentals are strong, and price movements in bank bonds are simply getting impacted from the general liquidity in the market. And as Joanne said, we do expect and know that the Fed is highly focused on improving this, and there's a lot of chatter about stuff coming in the next couple of days.
Excellent. I think that's really reassuring, thinking about the banking institutions as part of the solution this time instead of part of the problem, and understanding that they have immense amounts of liquidity on their balance sheets. They've been given almost a mandate, if you will, to start to lend into this environment and try and get liquidity going for companies. I think that with half of USDI invested in financials, that goes a long way in underpinning our conviction there in that investment strategy. So in order to keep this call really efficient and quick, I think I'm going to ask Bill Coley to see if there are any other final comments, and then we'd like to take as many questions as we can after Bill finishes up.
Sure. I just hit a couple points I wanted to come back to. I think when you go back to 2008, the banks and the broker dealers were really, I think, viewed as one of the the primary problems in sort of creating the situation that evolved, and that's clearly not the case here. The Fed, the Treasury Department, everybody's going to be working with the banks because they're viewed as part of the solution here and in a position, as we said, to do that. I think that this debate around, you know, the fiscal policy and element. And, you know, Mike just mentioned that, you know, the bank bonds, you know, being impacted by liquidity. You know, I want to be clear. Everything is being affected by liquidity here, right? The off-the-run U.S. Treasuries, the 30-year Treasury versus the 10-year Treasury, we're in, you know, the throes of a situation here where the you know, assets are being swung around because if you've got a net seller on one side or another, you know, it's moving the markets in a long way. So the bank bonds are not being targeted outright on that side overall. That said, you know, there are parts of the market that are going to be much more sort of at the will of what's going on the fiscal side. If you think about corporate earnings and some of the other stuff out there, that you know, that's going to be much more of a fiscal situation generally. I think the positive sign on this in terms of this fund and the assets that are being held in this fund are that the you know, there's direct responses here that can come out of a relatively efficient means that will put this in, you know, that will stabilize the CP market and the front end of the curve overall. And it is going to be the targeted variable that's coming out of the policymakers, because really you can't have the gaps in this part of the market and have the rest of the market stabilize as well. So if you're looking at you know, the corporate spread markets or other areas, you really need this front end of the curve to be operating more efficiently and more effectively for all of that. So I think it's going to be a high focus item generally. We're clearly in extraordinary times here. You know, this is a situation that I've been through many of these. This is different, and it's an area that we're going to have to respond to. I think that, you know, what I really wanted to finish up with here is to say that I think the team that you're working with is really, you know, is high quality and very seasoned. Joanne mentioned on the call, I've been, you know, in the business since the late 1980s. I've been through, you know, a lot of these different events before, but I've been at Putnam since 1994, and I've been, you know, we've been through the long-term capital management issues, the telecom, the dot-com situation unwind, the global financial crisis in 2008, and I've been at Putnam with the team that you're on the phone here with today. Joanne Driscoll, Mike Lima, and three other members of the team that are not on the call with us today that are all have day-to-day responsibility on this portfolio, all have between mid-20 and 30 years of experience at Putnam working in these markets and through these types of situations. So I feel good about the way the fund is positioned in terms of our ability to manage through the liquidity elements here. As Mike mentioned, you know, the fundamental loss risk in the portfolio is de minimis, and I think you've got the team in place to navigate these waters. So we can't do anything about the spread volatility in the near term, but more than comfortable with our ability to navigate through the liquidity.
Great. Thank you, Bill. So, Jacob, we're ready to take some questions now, if you could poll for questions.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by one. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. Your name is required to introduce your question. To withdraw your request, you may press star followed by number two. One moment, please, for the first question to queue up.
Okay, while we're doing that, you know, we have one question that had come in that was asking about, is the current market environment a liquidity crisis, and could it lead to a credit crisis? And it almost feels like two different things but intertwined. So I was wondering if Bill or Joanne, you had a few comments on that.
Sure. My short answer would be directly no, because what's happening with liquidity right now is really driven by technicals within the market. Right? Like Mike Lima had mentioned, this isn't a credit event, unlike what we saw in 2008. It's really this lack of balance sheet available for dealers to be able to buy paper when a fund experience outflows, which is why the Fed is stepping in and really putting in other measures to help provide that liquidity to the market.
Speakers, excuse me.
Yes, thank you, Jacob.
Yes. Hi, we have a first question from David's line. David, your line is open.
Thank you. A couple of questions. Number one is, what are the normal spreads for a 1 to 3 year? You talked about them elevating to like 1.5 above the 0.4. So what's the normal range? And kind of the corollary to that is, do you see the NAV, you know, bouncing back to 10.05, 10.06 because of liquidity, or is this a credit issue?
Sure. So the 1 to 3 year index, if I look over the last 10 years on average, was probably 80 to 90. So that's what I had mentioned at the beginning of the year when it had tightened into 40. We just didn't think it had any relative value. The valuations were severely stretched. But yeah, I can't forecast what our NAV will do, but if we can send you a copy of our deck that shows you our NAV movements and it's graphed up against the 1 to 3 year OAS, and it shows in different time periods, for instance, in the fourth quarter of December of 2018, when we saw some spread widening, what our NAV did, and then in the new year, as spreads tightened, how it behaved. And that's to sort of show you. I mean, it's not a one-for-one correlation because not all of the fund is in 1 to 3 year corporates. Only about half of it is. The other remaining are in ABS, repo, commercial paper, so the agencies and so forth. But it does give you a good sort of sense of how we move.
Thank you.
If there's not another question yet, another topic that has come up is about default risk within the underlying securities in ultra-short duration income funds. And I think this leads into, you know, how we think about quality positioning in the portfolio. And, Joanne, I wondered if you could comment on, you know, kind of your views on that, how we've been positioning the fund, and how you might think about that going forward.
Sure. So we talk about a sort of our barbell positioning, where our top credits, the higher rated by our internal analyst, would be what you'd see in the longer buckets, whereas in the shorter buckets, say 90 days and in, is where you'll see us have more of sort of the triple B, or a CP equivalent would be like A2. So we purposefully put the lower rated credits in the shorter maturities. And someone was asking us a question about that today, because there's a lot of talk out in the market about credit lines. And if you look at the triple Bs in the index, they have in total $900 billion available credit lines, and they have $450 billion of short-term debt, which is maturing in less than 1 year. So if you put that $900 billion credit line coupled with the cash on the balance sheet, this really should provide them some flexibility as their near-term obligations mature and the issue is assess how they want to address them.
I'll add to that. You know, folks ask about the bank's abilities to beat these credit draws. And I will point out that you know, the regulatory regime does contemplate that banks have to meet what's called a liquidity coverage ratio that stresses bank line draws. So this isn't something that's going to, you know, come as a shock to the way the bank's balance sheets are set up. You know, does that crowd out some high-quality assets on their balance sheet, and does that contribute to kind of some of the things we see in the market? Maybe, but banks are set up for liquidity line draws.
And also, we didn't talk as much in detail, but some of the options that the Fed has on the table that they could announce, one would be the commercial paper funding facility like they did in 2008, where they'll buy commercial paper directly from the issuer. And that was very successful during that time period. So that would also alleviate any of these firms having to access their credit lines. Another tool they could use is buying CP directly from dealer balance sheets. That probably wouldn't be used as widely, but it would actually free up some capacity that if money funds need to sell some commercial paper, the dealers will then in turn have balance sheet to buy it. And another thought out there is a money market investor funding facility, whereas the money funds can borrow directly from the Fed. So those are three things that have been thrown out into the market in terms of what we think they may potentially announce this week.
Interesting. Jacob, do we have any other questions on the line? Okay. Unless there are any final comments from the team on the phone, then I think perhaps we'll go ahead and wrap it up. All right, everyone, thank you very much. We really appreciate your participation today. It was a crazy day. It's been a wild month. I hope everyone is staying healthy. Thank you for participating in our call. And just
excuse me, Speaker.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I'm really sorry to interrupt you. I gathered the names of the participants who want to ask a question. We still have 7 questionnaire here.
Oh, great.
Would you like to take this?
Please.
Yes, I'm really sorry. Tim, your line is open.
Okay, yes. This is Tim Mabane. I'm a financial advisor with LPL Financial. I've been in the business registered since 1993. So I've been through a lot of crises like Bill and many of you here. My clients are going to want to know, you know, say that Dow, you know, drops another 10,000 points, which I, you know, I think it easily could. We're in a, you know, a total panic mode. How much lower do you think the ultra short duration income A can go? And do you ever see, do you see that the buck could be broken on, say, even the money market? Because we're seeing some hysteria out there, you know, people selling and, you know, they just can't take it. Like today, if you could just answer, do you have any idea how much ultra short duration income A dropped today? I'm assuming it did drop, but you guys tell me.
So just in terms of today, we can't comment because it doesn't price until 6 o'clock. So the team is going through pricing as we speak. We do pricing every day at the end of the day. The fund is not 100% correlated to the Dow, so it has to do more with what we were speaking about, the liquidity in the system and this risk-off tone. So by the Fed potentially coming out with one of these programs to provide the liquidity, that's going to be the direct positive impact to the fund that we're going to see, because that will calm the funding markets. Because if you sort of think through it, if, for instance, Anheuser-Busch doesn't have access to the CP market because people aren't buying, that's going to cause volatility across all of their bonds. For instance, because today they made an announcement that they were accessing their bank lines and people got concerned. So anything that the Fed can do to just help the funding market and the liquidity kind of open up that plumbing again that I had mentioned was clogged, that's going to be the direct benefit for this fund, money funds, and others. You know, having run money market funds in 2008, you know, yes, they stepped in, but they were a little too slow, which is why we saw that big run out. And, of course, that was different because it was a credit event with Lehman. But learning from experience, the Fed and the Treasury know they need to act quickly, that, like Bill had talked about, if the funding market isn't operating properly, it's not going to help the rest of the financial markets either.
Yeah, the liquidity piece isn't as hard to solve for the Fed, and you know they're very in tune to that relative to, you know, kind of the bigger picture macroeconomic concerns.
So did you guys say that you think – I missed the answer to your question. Do you think that this ultra-short duration income A will rebound a little bit as far as the NAV?
So I had mentioned if you look at historic time periods, and I think the fourth quarter of 2018 gives you a good example where we saw spreads widen, and then when we saw a retracement of that, when you saw our NAV do the same. I mean, it's not going to be a one-for-one, obviously, because it's a different situation, and we could have more economic impacts here, but, you know, it is something that is a good correlation to sort of look at what we've done historically.
And any idea how long that might take? I mean, people are going to be thrown out of work, and I know it's a credit spread and everything, but I won't hold you to it, but just how long do you think it might take to see a little bit of retracement?
Again, I think if we see an announcement by the Fed this week with some sort of liquidity tools to help the commercial paper market, that will alleviate. You know, as we have structured the portfolio, I mean, we've been thinking about this for, you know, not just this week, right? We've been thinking about this for some time when the news started breaking at the beginning of the year about the virus and what sectors that we might not want to have allocations to, for instance, cruise ships, right? We Royal Caribbean is a big issuer of commercial paper. We chose not to own that in this fund. So aside from what's happening in the general market, we have taken our positioning to the best of our ability, trying to forecast what could happen with the coronavirus and what industries might be affected. And there's others that will do very well, like a Procter & Gamble, right? So we've been thinking about it in multiple ways and been thinking about it for a few months now in terms of our positioning. And, you know, our analysts have been very proactive, whether it would be the energy sector, where that's been a very small exposure for us and very short. Again, cruise ships, some of the hotels. So we have other tools in our kit that we've used for this fund as well to make it more conservative.
And I know you don't handle the money market, but you don't anticipate that it could easily break the buck.
So I do also manage the money market funds. Now, the money market funds had two rounds of SEC regulations post-financial crisis that have really made them much more conservative. They have their daily and weekly liquidity limits, 10% and 30%. That makes them just a lot more liquid than what we've seen. And that's been one of the issues within the market, is that people are very nervous that there's any sort of issue in money market funds again, which is, again, why if the Fed releases one of these programs or a combination of a few of them, they understand that this worked in 08 and this will help that sector of the market as well, because that's the last place you want to see, you know, more volatility.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Joanne. It's helpful to know that the regulatory environment has been such that they've been trying to put in place some backstops since the crisis, which ultimately are starting to help this current situation. So, you know, I think with that, Jacob, are there other questions on the line?
Yes, we still have. Thank you, Tim. Jacob, your line is open.
Thank you very much. I think with Bill on the phone, I was wondering, could you give us some color on how the CMBX 6 trade is looking right now? And whether that thesis in the current environment that you had is still intact?
Yeah, so I'm happy to do that. I wanted to mention Joanne Ferullo mentioned a call on
Wednesday,
where we have, actually I'm speaking there as well, and I don't know that everybody here is as involved with that, but we'll talk more specifically to that strategy there. Like any of the areas of the market, you know, it has liquidity risk, and it's been under some stress as well. As we've highlighted before, I think the things that they're obviously very different than the assets that we're talking about in this fund, but a very short average life on that security, meaning that, you know, you can have a fairly meaningful widening without, in spread terms, without, you know, a lot of price performance overall. So it's feeling stress that we would still put down to liquidity constraints. Fundamental loss side, we're still very comfortable with it.
Even with the equity performance on a lot of the owners of the assets that are
what you need to remember is because the vintage is 2012, the property valuations on across the board in there are up sharply, 50%, 60%, 70% from issuance levels, and you had much tighter borrowing constraints at the time just to get that market sort of fired back up. So we run stress scenarios through all of the properties, and we're comfortable with the credit even under the stress scenarios.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you, Jacob. Our next question comes from Bob's line. Bob, your line is open.
My question is, do you know what has happened today to the 30-year fixed mortgage rate, and if you have any thoughts of it going forward?
Again, I can I can talk. We can talk a little bit more about this on Wednesday. The mortgage basis has been really volatile over the last few weeks. I know I got a. You know, as an anecdote, I know I got a call from my lender reaching out about, you know, refinancing the middle of last week. And when I went through the levels with them, I mean, they hadn't really, you know, despite the fact that you see the Treasury market as low as it is in many parts of the curve, I really wasn't picking up anything dramatically different than what I had on my existing run rate there overall. The immediate impact today of the mortgage basis, I know the mortgage rates rallied relatively meaningfully next to Treasuries, around 30 to 40 tighter this morning. That's not going to filter into a rate that you're going to see, though, in terms of, you know, the pipeline for some time. We're going to need a period of stability in rates in general, I think, before you really see an efficient application of refinancing opportunities in the mortgage market. The like any, you know, any fixed income manager will quote spreads. You know, we were talking about the 1 to 3 year spread on corporates or the mortgage basis or the CMBX or these other issues. But when you have treasuries moving like they're moving right now, and I think we've had 30 big figure handles on the 30-year bond in the last in over a 2-day period or something. So, you know, the reference rate there and spread is very, very difficult to hold any of the true assets accountable to it, because they're all just they're trading. So we're going to need things to calm down a bit before you can comfortably say what the mortgage spread looks like. And you're going to need the mortgage spread to be more stable before you're really going to see that accessible by refinancing. So unless you have a rate that was significantly higher from other time, I doubt that there's. You know, I know there's been a lot of talk around it, but I don't think it's moved dramatically from what I can tell.
Okay. So at this point, I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions. I wanted to see if there were any other questions that were focused on the short end or the Fed action or anything that's, you know, taken place over the last few days and with relation to the ultra short duration income fund.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Joanne, we still have three questionnaire here on queue. Would you like to take this?
Sure. We can take one or two more.
Okay, Joanne. And John, your line is open.
Yes. Hi, John Eggers here with LPL. There's so many questions, and I've been around this a while myself, and it always seems different, right? And so my question is, and it is directly correlated to the Fed and the front end of the curve, is at this point now it's indiscriminate selling. If anything, the yield curve has never looked better. We've got good inclination now. We've got the long end and the front end looking really good. It's been virtually flat, and it almost looked like the curve is going to be forced into negative without Fed action, which I think was really worrisome, but that sort of unwound itself. So my question is, buying begets buying, and selling begets selling, but it's exasperated on the downside. So it does become a liquidity question, and my question is, what is the appetite of the Fed? It seems like it's used so many tools over the last 10 years coming out of the financial crisis. How deep are those pockets? How far can they go at this point so as to avoid a liquidity crisis that could spill into a credit crisis? I know the credit spreads are blown open. That's natural. Everyone's looking for the quality to sell and or unloading the bad quality and going to good quality, and then they go beyond that. Really, how effective can the Fed be in an environment like this with indiscriminate selling and the rate of which the selling is happening? This part is unprecedented because we voluntarily have put the brakes on the economy, which is now putting a lot of pressure on it. How much can we withstand at this rate?
Well, I think it goes back to when we talk about why it's so important for the front-end liquidity markets to operate smoothly, because they are really the base for everything else. So if they can free up what's happening in commercial paper, you know, that allows more balance sheet room for other securities. Plus, you know, if a firm has a actively issuing commercial paper and it's operating very smoothly, that's going to help them in many other ways too, because they have that cash flow that they're able to put to work, whether it's paying their employees or buying back maybe some their own bonds because the prices look like they are pretty much, you know, in a place where they think that would work. So again, starting with just really easing the liquidity in the commercial paper market will really serve to sort of the other parts of the market. It will bring down sort of like a trickle-down effect to help the companies across the board. And that's why, I had a conversation today with the Fed. They are very much aware of what's going on. They've reached out to a lot of people like myself and are having these discussions. They've rolled out these programs in 2008, so it's been done before. So I think it's something that's a known factor. It's known to work. So Again, we had thought they might announce this last night, but from what we gather from talking to others today, they didn't want to do everything at once. They kind of wanted to take their time to assess this one. So we're hoping in the next day or two we do see some sort of announcement regarding the commercial paper market.
And so they have.
Can I just jump in? I just wanted to say that, you know, I think that the facility exists. They just have to turn it on. And to the extent that they turn on the funding facility, we would expect the response in the commercial paper market to be immediate. I mean, I think there was already an anticipation of this, and so you're seeing a little bit of this uncertainty. And so you'll see an immediate stabilization on that side, and that will free up balance sheet that could then roll into other parts of the curve, you know, a little bit further out, and areas that are tied up right now, you know, for various reasons, would all of a sudden become more free access. So those might take a little more time, but I think the CP side would be, you know, a fairly immediate response.
So they have further they can go. They have plenty of room here to buffer.
Yeah, I mean, they can tap into the Fed. I mean, they can tap into the Fed's balance sheet, provided this is turned on directly. So they have, you know, trillions. I don't want to sound like, you know, but they, you know, they have lots of access.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Even today, they added an additional lending facility, an overnight repo operation, and these haven't even been fully subscribed. So they added, you know, another $500 billion today at around noontime, and immediately you started to see a snapback in the repo market, and it was behaving better.
That was a segue to my follow-up question.
Oh, sure.
Were there canaries in the coal mine regarding liquidity issues in the repo, and is that correlating now or exacerbating the problem at all, or is that relatively resolved or in check?
It's in check, and I think the reason they did the $500 billion at noon today is because repo was starting to behave a little messy today. We started seeing it spiking a little bit, nothing like we saw last year. So they immediately added that $500 billion at noon. Now, they also have a one-month and a three-month operation, both $500 billion each in size, and neither of those have been fully subscribed. They're only about under 100 in total is being utilized. So there's plenty of liquidity they put out there into the system, which is why the next step we're thinking is they actually have to affect the credit, not just what's going on in the repo market. I think they've got the repo market covered.
And just my final question that correlates ties into everything. Does the ETF offer any liquidity options? In other words, if there is no bid on the bond on paper that you need to sell, can you go to the ETF market and sell short the stock? You know, an ETF correlated in some type of fixed income that you're trying to sell. Is there any correlation there, or is that market just way too small to even consider for liquidity reasons?
I think in the front end, it's not, you know, this sounds again like a little bit more of a back end question. The ETF market is not super deep if you look at the amount of IG corporate exposure out there.
Right.
In some of the big
like LQD, that's a popular
like
one.
That.
It's been the volume
yeah,
on
the
LQD.
The ETF is not, you know, doesn't come close to the size
right.
that you see
okay.
in those underlying assets.
Right.
And you have a basis risk there as well. I mean, I think that, you know, it's important to understand is that the value of the ETF can move quite dramatically from the value of the underlying assets there.
Yeah,
so while you can sell it, you sell it at a price that is, you know, a price that you probably wouldn't recognize if you were selling a cash security.
But is that not an alternative versus no bid in the paper?
A better alternative for if you're looking at hedging
right.
reduction risk or something. I mean, the first and foremost risk that a manager in a fixed income asset would be interested in managing would be the duration exposure, and
right.
you can do that much easier through the swaps market or through the futures market or something like
Very
that.
Good.
The standalone credit component there is not really a dominant risk in that IG space.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, John,
Thank
for your
you, John.
Questions. Jacob, do we have more in the queue, please?
Yes, Joanne, we still have two questions on queue.
Okay.
Our next question comes from Ricardo's line. Ricardo, your line is open.
Yes, hi, thank you. This is Ricardo Joffrey at Morgan Stanley. Could you discuss how you're managing redemptions right now? Do you have sufficient liquidity with just the daily maturities, or are you having to engage in forced selling? Maybe drill down that. Thank you.
Specific to USDI?
The ultra short duration.
And can we talk about that, Joanne? We have, like I mentioned at the beginning of the call, we have that natural laddering of our maturities. So every day, you know, we have somewhere roughly around 3% maturing, and that's been sufficient. We feel we're in a good place. I purposely always keep maturities very high because we don't want to have to be a forced seller. So we don't want to have, so you saw that in December of 2018, kept maturities very high because this is not the type of market you want to be selling into. However, if we do have to sell, we also always maintain a list of very highly liquid securities. For instance, you know, we own some government agencies that are, you know, very highly rated, very liquid type securities, other high quality assets. So we have a couple of tools that we would utilize.
Okay, so presumably if spreads normalize, the underlying paper should be snapping back and reflected in the NAV?
Right, exactly.
That's correct. And just to be clear again, I'll step in on the, when we talk about managing liquidity risk, and again, that was a key in 08, you know, it's been a key really since 08 in various environments overall. There's two ways you can see, you know, you might get hurt in liquidity risk. One is in day-to-day price volatility, and you can see that naturally in the NAV. So that's where you have the spreads widen or something like that, and we would argue that you've been paid to hold liquidity risk over time, and we think that day will come back again. The second way you would get hurt is if you were a forced seller, if you had to sell in a market that was gapping or was down, and this would go across any of the funds that were here. And so one of the keys that we've really hammered home with all of our products, with all of our portfolio manager teams for the last 10 years has been managing liquidity in an open-ended fund. So we don't want to be an open, you know, we don't want to be a forced seller in that environment. And I think that's something that we've done very well. I think we're navigating through this very well at the same time. So I'm comfortable on that side.
Okay, thank you.
Great. And is there one last question in the queue, Jacob?
Yes, John. We have a last question on queue from Scott's line. Scott, your line is open.
Thank you. This is Scott Olson, Institutional Consulting from UBS. This is really good. You guys did a great job. I'm just curious, with about 75% of the portfolio in commercial paper and corporates, is that typical, or has there ever been a time when there's been more treasuries allocated, other type of government paper in the portfolio?
No, that's pretty typical. The corporates versus CP can vary, but from our perspective, it's the same credit risk. So it depends on where we want to be on the curve. So last year, as we were extending duration, you saw us buying more like one-year corporates. So that, because CP only goes out, you know, to about 10 months or so, so you'll see us owning more corporate at that point in time. So part of it, again, is where we want to be in the curve, what we're trying to do with our duration. But the total makeup of credit, about 75% of the portfolio, that's been consistent through the life of the fund.
Yeah, one of the things that we've done historically in the portfolio is to limit some of the exposure to securitized investments. Not that they're not great diversifiers and not great additions to yield, but they do add more volatility to the portfolio with prepayments and things that we don't have control over as a portfolio manager. So over the history of SCI, it's been primarily a corporate credit invested portfolio.
Okay, thank you.
Great. So, Jacob, are we pretty much done with the queue there?
Actually, Joanne, we still have one.
Okay.
From Tim's line. Would you like to take this question?
Yes, please.
All right. Tim, your line is open.
Thanks, Joanne. You've been very helpful. Tim Mabane again, LPL. So I usually, you know, when the value's down, the yield is up. Do you expect the yield to go up for ultra short duration income A with this drop in the NAV price?
So, you know, we have obviously rates declining at the same time. So right now it's pretty hard to forecast. You know, on the one hand, we benefit when we have things that wider spreads, you know, because we do have a lot of LIBOR-based floaters. But at the same time, the rates market's dropping. So for me right now, that's a little bit hard to forecast. I don't know if anyone else has a comment on that.
Well, I think that generally as rates are going lower anyway, the yield in the portfolio would decline at the front end. At the end of the day, though, there still is spread over and above treasuries and over and above LIBOR that we are earning and earning carry on the portfolio over time. So it's going to be difficult to predict exactly where the distribution yield is going to go, but that's part of why we invest in spread assets and have a little bit of extra there in order to generate income in the fund.
Right. You just think it is a worst case scenario if ultra short duration income may drop 10%, which would be a nightmare for all of us, that usually the yield would go up, value down, yield up, but barring a kind of a drastic scenario like that, are you saying it's kind of hard to predict?
Well, I think it's difficult to predict to a very fine extent. Like, I don't want to give you a false sense of precision there, but I mean, just generally speaking, given that roughly half the fund is in floating rate corporate type securities based off of LIBOR, as LIBOR comes down, you'd see those yields come down a little bit. But when you're thinking about the broader overall market and spreads widen again and, and yields go up, you'd have to reinvest and be able to capture those yields to generate coupon and income in the portfolio.
It's probably important to point out, too, on those LIBOR-based floaters, all the resets are different. So they're off a three-month LIBOR, but it's going to be based on when the bond was issued. So just because LIBOR drops today doesn't mean that one particular bond is going to drop today. It will drop when its next reset period comes up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Joanne, as of the moment, we don't have a question on queue. You may proceed.
Okay, great. Well, then, in that case, I think we're going to go ahead and wrap it up. It's been about an hour or so. We really appreciate everyone participating in the call today. We appreciate your questions. If you have follow-up questions after this, again, please reach out to your Putnam Consulting team. You can also call 800-354-4000 or go to putnam.com. And just a quick reminder on the advisor call series that we're going to have this coming week. Again, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 1:15 in the afternoon. The first one tomorrow is Don Connolly, our senior mentor to financial advisors, who can help you navigate talking to your clients about market volatility in a simple way. Wednesday, our senior portfolio managers and discussing the current market environment, recent volatility. And then Thursday, some strategies for wealth management in these critical times. So thank you very much. I hope everyone stays healthy and good luck navigating these markets. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes for today's conference. Thank you so much for participating. You may now disconnect.
Thank you.
Speakers.